talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the lives and afterlives of the six women who married Henry VIII as we find out why their stories have inspired so many writers, filmmakers and artists over the centuries. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. The women who married Henry VIII have come to be encapsulated in a six-word rhyme: divorced, beheaded, died. Divorced, beheaded, survived. But what were their real stories and legacies? Well, a new book and a new exhibition at the National Portrait Gallery in London called Six Lives, The Stories of Henry VIII's Queens, reveals the extraordinary lives and afterlives of Catherine of Aragon, Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour, Anne of Cleves, Catherine Howard and Catherine Parr. And in tonight's show, we want to find out about their lives. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Charlotte Bolland is the Senior Curator for 16th Century Collections at the National Portrait Gallery in London, an expert on the Tudor court. She is the curator of the Six Lives exhibition and the editor of the book accompanying it, Six Lives, The Stories of Henry VIII's Queens, published by the National Portrait Gallery. Dr. Nikki Clark lectures in early modern history at the University of Chichester, an expert on the Tudors. She's the author of The Waiting Game, The Untold Story of the Women Who Served the Tudor Queens, as well as the book Gender, Family and Politics. And she wrote the essay on Ladies in Waiting for the book Six Lives. Dr. Nicola Tallis is a prolific author, historian and historical consultant, and her books include Crown of Blood, The Deadly Inheritance of Lady Jane Grey, as well as All the Queen's Jewels, Power, Majesty and Display. And her most recent book is Young Elizabeth, Princess, Prisoner, Queen. And she wrote the essay about the Queen's Jewels for the Six Lives book. Well, you are all very welcome. And Charlotte, I might begin with you as the creator of this exhibition, because there has always been interest in the lives of these six women. But I think it was always in terms of the marriages to Henry, whether they lived or were killed or what happened to them, you know, that rhyme, divorced, beheaded, died and so on. But now I think in recent years with Six the Musical and with this exhibition and book and with the way we approach it now, it's very much more in terms of telling their stories and not just in terms of Henry.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the things that's sort of so interesting about these women, because their stories have been sort of interest for centuries and keep being retold, that often the way in which they're retold sort of says something more about the person doing the telling of the story rather than necessarily reaching a kind of truth of the 16th century. And I think there's an awareness now that their sort of individual stories have been overshadowed. And part of that is because of the sort of power of that rhyme in remembering the way in which they were sort of their marriages to Henry ended. And also, which is something that's sort of particularly appropriate to the National Portrait Gallery, of the way in which their images have been used and kind of homogenized into group sets. so that that identity of them as a group of six women has kind of become much stronger than their individual stories.
And why do you think we have been throughout the century so interested in their lives? Is it because of that whole interest in the Tudor era and the drama and excitement of it? Because it has been such a fertile ground for artists, for writers, for filmmakers. It has captured the imagination and it continues to capture the imagination.
Yes, and it sort of, you know, kind of starts almost with Shakespeare. So it's a sort of founding storytelling. The power is there to see that's kind of unfolded over the centuries. And I think it's that mix of these huge kind of important changes that happen in the course of Henry VIII's reign, most notably in religion and the questions of the Reformation. So really foundational questions about people's souls and their kind of personal beliefs that are then overlaid with this really almost implausible melodrama of the human lives of all the sort of participants who are enacting this huge change over the nation. And I think that sort of humanity and fallibility has what's been such fertile ground for storytellers. And also in a way that there's enough historical information in the sources to get a kind of really rich picture, but it can never be complete. And so the historical imagination and then kind of onwards into fictional retelling, there's this sort of space to reconsider the queens and all the individuals of the court from different perspectives. So I think it's that mix of having a shared understanding of the principles of the story, but enough space for kind of creative thinking and narrative to give people that to try and access people's individuality.
So, Charlotte, tell us about the exhibition then. Tell us about the book. Tell us about the way you approached retelling the story of these six women.
Well, so in the exhibition, I really wanted to kind of meet people where we are in the 21st century and to think about all the layering of storytelling that we have in our head. And so you can see that in the kind of opening works of the exhibition, which are also the cover for the accompanying book, which are these six extraordinary large-scale photographs by the Japanese artist Hiroshi Sugimoto, which have this really uncanny quality. They're sort of black and white, beautifully lit, of each of the six queens. But they're, you sort of feel that you want to bring them to life, but actually they are photographs of waxworks from Madame Tussauds. So it's sort of that idea of they're kind of, they're impossible to sort of reach over time and the stories that we bring when we look at these images. And that is something that has been played with portraitures for centuries. So I've kind of juxtaposed at the beginning of the exhibition and also on the back of the book cover, the full-length portrait of Henry VIII by Hans Holbein the Younger, which is one of the sort of icons of portraiture made in England, because Henry's image is so fixed in our imagination that we have, he's very easy to kind of picture with that sort of wide leg stance, the broad shoulders and staring out, and a picture that it's, you never actually really have eye contact with it because it's so large. You're always looking up at it. So you're always in that sort of position of deference to him. And it's been used as a vehicle for storytelling for centuries. An amazing play at the beginning of the 17th century is called When You See Me, You Know Me, and has an image of that. So that's something I really wanted to think about, what's in our minds now, what's familiar and what's unfamiliar, and then to track it back to the 16th century. And in that, one of the key means by which we've learned about these women is through performance. So thinking about sort of page, stage and screen of the kind of novels, theatre, so from Hilary Mantel's Mirror and the Light to Six the Musical, and also to onwards into screen with film. And then kind of going back further in time into the 16th century. And that is where I really wanted to draw on the expertise of contributors to the publications, of, including Nicola and Nikki, to really bring out those kind of individual elements to bring real sort of depth and texture to understanding of the 16th century and the world in which the queens lived and the kind of context of court culture.
Nikki, if we were to look at the six lives, Catherine of Aragon, Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour, Anne of Cleves, Catherine Howard, Catherine Parr, in some ways, is there a particular one that stands out as having more attention based around? Is it Anne Boleyn because she was the famous, the, I suppose, the reason for the divorce and then the way she was beheaded? Is it Catherine Parr for surviving? You know, is there a particular one that stands out for you?
Oh, I think what stands out for me versus what often stands out in general is perhaps not the same thing. So for me, Catherine of Aragon stands out because I think we often think six wives and we assume that they were each Henry's wife for a comparable length of time, that we've got six wives fairly evenly divided across his reign. But that's not the case at all. Catherine of Aragon is Henry's queen for over half of the reign. So for really 20 years. And then the others really follow in quite quick succession. Once he's got rid of one wife, it seems to happen with great rapidity for the second half of his reign. So for me, it's often Catherine of Aragon who I find interesting. And that is to some degree reflected in the source material. There are some sorts of sources that we have for Catherine of Aragon's reign that we have much less of for the other queens, purely because they were queen for so little time that lots of records simply weren't preserved. However, I think that in the public imagination, for sure, Anne Boleyn is often the one who stands out. So I've done a number of events that are based around the six wives, and a couple of times we've polled the audience for their favourite wife before and then after all the talks to see if we can change any minds. Anne Boleyn does usually win. And I think that's partly because, certainly nowadays, she really echoes a sense of, I suppose, feminism and being ahead of her time and being independent-minded and all of these things that we now value very strongly and we really relate to. At the time, perhaps not so much, and I think it's dangerous to suggest that she herself was a feminist when that wasn't really a concept that yet existed. But I do think she speaks to current concerns in that way.
And Catherine of Aragon, she was loved by the people in England even after the divorce. And when she died in the 1530s, she was mourned by the people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes. So there were times during, I suppose, what you'd call the changeover between the two queens, where Catherine is being sent increasingly far away and the king is travelling on progress with Anne Boleyn instead. And they really struggle to travel because people line the walkways to throw things at her and to boo and to make unpleasant remarks and things like that. At one point, there's a riot in London against Anne Boleyn and in favour of Catherine of Aragon and her daughter, Princess Mary. So yes, absolutely. At the time, lots of people think that the king's treatment of Catherine of Aragon is absolutely not okay.
What about Jane Seymour then, the third wife? Because she died of natural causes in childbirth, and some say that she suggests that she was the only one he perhaps really loved, or that she was his favourite. But, you know, she seems to, she escaped the tragedies of being divorced or beheaded.
She did. Yes, it is often said that she's the only wife that Henry really loved. And being a bit of a cynic, I do have to wonder whether it's simply because, A, she gave him the son that he was so desperate for to secure the succession, but also because she died so early on, she hadn't really yet had time to sour his impression of her, so to speak. She hadn't had time to do anything that might have annoyed him.
I don't want the show to be about Henry, because it is the idea of focusing on the lives of these women. But how do you view Henry VIII? Because again, in the history books, you have all these different interpretations. In the fictional representations, you have all of these different interpretations. And it's anything from this dynamic man of energy to someone who is kind of a bit of a psychopath and tyrant who is just dangerous to know.
Yes, I think, for me, it's definitely more towards the psychopath and tyrant line, and I think that's common among historians these days. I think that if you are told yes a lot of the time and then somebody tries to tell you no, it doesn't go down very well. Henry believed that he was born to rule, he was chosen by God, but he also had a very strong need to be right and to be able to believe that he himself was right, but he did expect the world to rearrange itself around him to make that possible.
Nicola Tallis, I'll bring you in on this because it is fascinating when we look at how these women tried to navigate the corridors of power. They tried to survive and thrive despite the very cutthroat politics of the time, when it literally was cutthroat for some of them.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and you have to bear in mind, particularly in the cases of Henry's latter wives, that they had the example of their predecessors before them. So, you know, they had seen the way in which Henry had treated Catherine of Aragon, as Nikki mentioned, and seen the way in which Henry had disposed of Anne Boleyn. So I think it's very fair and true to say that Henry wasn't the most prepossessing of grooms, and that, you know, these women would have been very wary, to say the least, when they were making their marriage vows.
What's your view of Anne of Cleves? Because, again, the view is that he just took one look at her and didn't like her in the wonderful Hilary Mantel trilogy. You know, her ugliness is the cause of Thomas Cromwell's downfall, whereas, you know, I think the Thomas Cromwell that she has created in the books would probably have been shrewd enough to have avoided that particular disaster. But how much of that imagery is correct?
Well, I think Anne of Cleves, I mean, there is no doubt that she wasn't to Henry's personal taste, and that, you know, physically he found himself repelled by her. That is beyond question. You know, Henry's courtiers were talking about the fact that, you know, Henry didn't like her. But Anne herself, initially at least, didn't appear to have any indication or any, you know, clue as to Henry's true feelings towards her. Outwardly, he was very courteous to her, very generous to her, and very pleasant to her. And to all intents and purposes, she seemed to feel that the marriage was going very, very well. And I think that Anne has been given a bad deal in lots of ways. She's been very much overlooked and dismissed as being the wife that only lasted for 6 months. And I think we need to give her more agency than that, because ultimately, she was really the great survivor of Henry's wives, and she did really come out of it quite well. When Henry separated from her, she was given a series of palaces, she was allowed to keep hold of her jewels, and she was given the title of the king's sister. So really, I think that she came out of it with a better deal than her contemporaries.
Charlotte, there is a wonderful website that accompanies the exhibition. It's npg.org.uk, and on it you can download a PDF, a full 163-page exhibition guide in large print, and there's a digital guide. And, you know, it is incredible the way you can get these insights into them. But I'm wondering, when you look at the portraits of the six women, how much can we tell from historic portraiture, given that, I suppose, our views of what is beautiful and what is elegant is probably very different in the 21st century to what it was in the 16th century.
Yes, and it's really important to consider, when looking at portraits, their sort of specificity, you know, their scale, that there's, what is the purpose of the portrait? So, for example, we have in the exhibition the beautiful miniature by Hans Holbein the Younger of Anne of Cleves, that is the miniature that was sort of created for Henry to fall in love with Anne. It was that kind of... the scale of it is something to be carried around and to sort of inspire personal devotion and to kind of conjure up a relationship in his imagination prior to her arrival. So that really kind of speaks a lot about Henry, almost, in the kind of function of that object. And by contrast, we have a fascinating half-length portrait of Catherine Parr in the exhibition that hasn't been on public display before, and which Catherine Parr was very interested in commissioning portraits herself from a number of artists. And in this portrait, there's a tiny detail of bracelets at her wrist, which have Latin phrasing of Laus Deus, praise God. But it's a very specific phrase in Latin, which Susanna Lipscomb has written about in the exhibition publication, from the Vulgate Bible, about praising God in silence. And there's something really interesting there that I think does give insight into Catherine Parr, very unusually, of that both a kind of play perhaps on portraiture, of that idea that even her silent image of the portrait is still able to praise God. But it's also produced at the moment after Catherine has really had to silence herself, that her interest in religious reform and her status at court, there was a moment when conservative moved against her. And she was, you know, kind of nearly arrested and under threat of arrest for possession of heretical books. And she survived by basically sort of professing to Henry that her and apologizing and saying that she should never have talked to him about religion, that she was just a woman. So really kind of debasing herself before him in an effort to survive. And I think there's something really interesting in all her magnificent jewels. This portrait is sort of studded with pearls and diamonds. You have this little glimpse of praising God in silence at a moment when she has silenced herself to survive.
And Nikki, about 15 years ago, we did a show, I think it was maybe on Henry VIII, but we had Natalie Dormer on because she was starring at that time in The Tudors playing Anne Boleyn. And what fascinated me was that she really had done her historical research into the character. She knew all about her. She knew the poems. She knew the smear campaigns that had been run against her and her brother, that she had immersed herself in the history for the playing of the role. There is something about the way that these lives are dynamic that when you look at Anne Boleyn, you know, maybe that it is read with a feminist interpretation, but it's a life that leads itself to all these different kinds of interpretations.
Yes, absolutely. There are so many elements really to all of these queens' lives, and there are different ways that you can read the surviving source material. Interpretations do tend to change over time and with subsequent generations, and I'm sure that they will continue to do so. It's the thing I love about this exhibition is exactly what Charlotte said about meeting us where we are now with the six wives. And I'm sure that will continue to happen.
Catherine Howard then, she was the fifth and she was also beheaded. So what went wrong with that marriage?
Well, Catherine Howard had two liaisons with other men before she married Henry VIII, which would not on its own have cost her life. But during the course of the investigation into those, once they were discovered, she gave herself away. And it was found out that she was also potentially having an affair with one of Henry VIII's gentlemen of the Privy Chamber during her marriage while she was queen. And it was that really that cost her her life.
And then finally, we have Catherine Parr, and she ended up surviving Henry because he died before her. He died in 1547. So was she lucky then? Do you think it would have gone wrong if he had survived for longer? Because it seemed like he was in this cycle then of wanting this high turnover, and he almost seemed to relish it.
Yes, I'm not sure it's true to say he relished it, but I do think that with the atmosphere at the time of religious reform and a lot of pushback from religious conservatives, Catherine Parr had already fallen foul of them. Henry was, on that occasion, potentially prepared to get rid of her. I think that, yes, she was lucky, because eventually something similar probably would have happened again.
And Henry was actually her third husband, third of four husbands.
Yes, that's right. She'd been married twice before, and she married once more after Henry's death.
So when you look at all of this, I sometimes wonder why Henry felt compelled. Was it in the early days, was it this the desire, that strong compulsion to have a male heir? Was that still the compulsion in the later years?
It's difficult to say. I think reasonably, if he was thinking reasonably, it's unlikely he could have fathered a male heir later on in his reign, based on what we know about his health. And also what we know particularly about Catherine Parr, she had no children by her previous husband. So it may have been thought that she herself was barren, although she did go on to have a daughter with her final husband after Henry's death.
Well, tonight we are talking about the six lives of Henry VIII's queens. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll find out about the Queen's jewels. We'll find out about the ladies in waiting. And we'll also find out about the fictional representations of these six women. So stay with us here on News Talk. Well, welcome back. We're talking history, and we are talking about the six lives of the women who were married to Henry VIII. I'm rejoined by my expert pal, Dr. Charlotte Bolland, who's the senior curator for 16th century collections at the National Portrait Gallery in London, and who is the curator of that Six Lives exhibition, Dr. Nikki Clark of the University of Chichester, who wrote the essay on Ladies in Waiting for that book, and Dr. Nicola Tallis, who wrote the essay on the Queen's jewels for that book. And Nicola, I'd love to ask you about the jewels, because one of your books is All the Queen's Jewels, looking at power, majesty and display. And what can we learn by looking at the jewels and looking at the possessions of these six women?
Well, we can learn so much about them, both as individuals and as consorts, because jewels were really an insight into somebody's personality. They weren't only adornments that looked beautiful, but they were often intended to make displays of majesty, of grandeur, and they often contained messages as well about the way in which an individual wanted to portray themselves. And we see plenty of this in the instances of these six women.
And do you think it reflected, there was more than decoration, that was it an explicit presentation of their authority, that they wanted to show their wealth, they wanted to maybe make a statement about where they were in the society and in the state?
Yes, absolutely that. So it was pivotal with their position as queens that they impressed. So they needed to impress their subjects, they needed to impress their courtiers, their friends, their family, and these jewels were a crucial way of doing that. They really, really highlighted these women's status, and they were a representation of Henry himself in many ways, and of the Tudor dynasty, of which they were all an integral part.
And were they happy to accept jewels that had belonged to a previous queen, or did they always want it to be new materials?
Well, there was a bit of both. Whether they were technically happy to receive jewels that had been the property of an executed predecessor, we can only guess that. But certainly that is what happened. And there was certainly a core collection which passed from queen to queen. And individual queens also seem to have added to this collection. So, for example, we know that Anne of Cleves, although she was only queen for 6 months, she spent the modern day equivalent of thousands of pounds on adding to the collection. You know, in one instance, she spent the modern day equivalent of almost £12,000 on a single diamond. And then we've got Catherine Parr, who was also very, very conscious of the projection of the royal image and the way in which jewels could help her to do this. And she seems to have been quite fond of the theme of royalty in her jewels. And we know that she was commissioning pieces that featured crowns, for example, a brooch that was shaped like a crown. So there was a core collection that was passed from queen to queen, but we do also see individual queens attempting to put their own stamp on this collection too.
And Nicola, was it that there were landmarks in their life that were marked by the giving of jewellery, whether it was the birth of a child or whether it was the engagement or so on? Like, was it almost as a way of marking out key moments in the life for the reign as far as Henry was concerned?
Yeah, absolutely. And we see evidence of this, particularly in Catherine Howard's case, when we have an inventory of her jewels, and there are notes in this inventory which tell us when she was given certain pieces. And a number of these were given to her by Henry, you know, to mark their marriage as New Year's gifts. So she seems to have been a particularly fortunate recipient of jewels. And yet there are numerous instances besides when we see these queens receiving jewels to mark these key life moments, and also giving jewels to mark these key life moments. So we see, for example, Catherine Parr giving her stepdaughter, Mary, a pair of bracelets shortly after her marriage to Henry VIII. And this is almost certainly an attempt by Catherine to foster good relations with her new stepdaughter. So they're given for all manner of reasons and on numerous occasions.
And I was reading in your book that when Jane Seymour died, and she died prematurely, that some of her jewels were given as gifts to members of her household in reward for their service. And, you know, maybe they weren't the most expensive or the most valuable of the jewels, but I thought that was a nice gesture of respect and a gesture of thanks for all the help she'd received.
Yeah, absolutely. And those were intended really, as you say, as thanks, as a personal reminder of the queen that these women had served. But also, they were quite convenient for Henry VIII, because these jewels provided him with a means of rewarding these women who had shown his wife such good service, but also without incurring extra costs for him. So there was a really, really handy extra point there as well.
And, you know, in your book, you do have the inventories for some of the queens, and the amount of jewels they had in terms of rings and stones, necklaces and clasps and brooches and everything, it really is quite impressive and quite extensive.
Oh, it's absolutely staggering. Yes. So, you know, we see, for example, with Jane Seymour's inventory, that lists over 500 pieces of jewellery. And then we look at Catherine Howard and Catherine Parr. They've got just under 200 pieces of jewellery each. So this is a huge collection. It's also a very valuable collection, and, you know, made of the most costly materials in most instances, and really brought out when these queens want to impress or make a statement. But yeah, these inventories, they really do give us an incredible insight into the material wealth that these queens had access to.
And, you know, I said impressive, you know, I suppose I could also have said obscene in the huge quantity of it. But it brings it back to that element that you have in the subtitle, power, that this is a way of the king as well, of Henry showing his power and his wealth and his success and his greatness by the fact that there can be so many jewels given to his queen and on display.
Yes, exactly that. So Henry, of course, it's pivotal that he looks good, and he has an enormous jewel collection, much bigger than any of his wives. And of course, he has to look good. But then his wives are also representing his dynasty. So it's crucial that they too should look the part, and that they should wear these jewels as statements of who they are and as his consorts. So yes, they definitely, they're sort of like the tools of the trade in many ways. They're the toolkit that each queen receives in order to be able to do her job and to play her role as Henry's wife.
Were there any in particular that stood out to you as particularly impressive or beautiful or obscenely expensive?
Well, I think I mentioned Anne of Cleves, and what's quite interesting in her account is that she commissions a brooch telling the story of Samson, and that was a particularly expensive piece. And what's quite interesting about that is that there is something very similar, a very similar piece that ends up in the inventory of Henry VIII. And we don't know for sure if it's the same one, but I think that it's a tantalising possibility. And I think the associations that perhaps Anne was attempting to make between her husband and Samson were perhaps a way of trying to flatter Henry that I think is maybe quite interesting. Like I say, it's tantalising, it's intriguing, we don't know for sure, but I think it's certainly a possibility we have to consider.
Nikki, your brilliant new book is The Waiting Game, the untold story of the women who served the Tudor queens. And what really struck me was the fact that these ladies in waiting had an incredible loyalty towards their queen, and then how much they hated anyone who crossed the woman they were serving.
Yes, that's often the case. Particularly, I have to say, with Catherine of Aragon. So there are some of her ladies-in-waiting who refused to leave her service when she was sent away from court. And there are women who refused to take a new oath of service to her when she was demoted from queen to being princess dowager. They said it would be perjury to take a new oath, but it's just a way of digging their heels in and refusing to conform to what the king wants. And the king is absolutely furious, because not only can he not get his queen to do what he wants, even more women are now defying him by refusing to fall in with his wishes.
And do we know how they treated their ladies in waiting? How I suppose, how kind or unkind they were, how demanding they might have been, and how they might have behaved, not just then in public, but also in private?
In general, they seem to have been pretty good to their ladies in waiting. And that does make sense, because these people are helping you get dressed. There are a lot of pins involved, and it would be very easy to slip, wouldn't it? So I think it didn't make sense for them to mistreat the women who were around them and who were their constant companions. In many cases, there do seem to have been genuine friendships, insofar as a queen can ever have friends on a, you know, of people of a similar social level. But yes, there are plenty of examples of queens being very close, usually to a few ladies-in-waiting, although there might be a bigger group there. But in general, yes, they behave nicely towards them.
And what happened to them when their queen died, well, was beheaded or divorced or died of natural causes? What happened to them then?
That really depends. So whenever there is a queen who dies or a queen who is beheaded, if there is a gap between that and the next queen, then the household is disbanded and the women are in theory sent home. But in practice, they might instead join a different royal female household. So there are gaps, for instance, between Catherine Howard and Catherine Parr, for example. When Princess Mary's household becomes the number one royal female household in the country, because it's useful to have a royal woman at court, it means there are women to dance with, say, visiting ambassadors and things like that. So it makes sense for there to be women around. And when there isn't a queen, if there's a princess who's old enough, she tends to step up and her household will expand during that time. So yes, some of a queen's women might go there. Some of them will simply leave royal service and go home. Some of them might hang about waiting for the next queen. Or if the changeover is very fast, so for instance, between Anne Boleyn and Jane Seymour, Anne is beheaded and the king marries Jane Seymour within days, it is common for women to simply move directly into the new queen's household. And that does make sense, because ladies in waiting often have a lot of experience. And a lot of Henry's queens, Jane Seymour being one of them, have not been raised to be queens. So they are aristocratic women, but they're not princesses. And they haven't always been at court for very long before they're made queen. So they don't know how things work. So they need the help of those experienced ladies in waiting to be able to step into that role and pick the job up running, I suppose.
Tell me about Jane Parker. She married the brother of Anne Boleyn. I think she was a lady-in-waiting for the third and fourth queen, but she seems to have played an important role in both the execution of Anne Boleyn and the fifth queen.
Yes, that's true. So Jane Parker is one of only a few women who definitely served at least five of six wives. So Jane served five wives. She joined the court under Catherine of Aragon, and she was executed at the end of Catherine Howard's reign. And yes, because she is Anne Boleyn's sister-in-law, she moves straight into Anne Boleyn's household. She is there when Anne is arrested. She may have given some evidence, or she did give some evidence, of private conversations that she'd had with Anne and that Anne had had with her brother George that did help to make the case against them, although I do not think that was Jane's actual intention. There is no advantage to her in seeing her husband and her sister-in-law executed. She does all right after that. She moved into Jane Seymour's service. She then moved to Anne of Cleves. By this point, she is very experienced, and she's someone who they need around to help Anne of Cleves work out what's going on and how things work. She is one of the women who testifies against Anne of Cleves, saying that the king and Anne have never slept together, and that helps the annulment to go through. She then moves into Catherine Howard's service, and she is then the lady-in-waiting who helps arrange liaisons between Catherine Howard and Thomas Culpeper, one of the king's gentlemen of the Privy Chamber. And it's not clear quite why she does this, and I still, even having written about it, and read all the sources for a long time, I still don't have a very clear answer. And I think that probably means there isn't one. It doesn't make sense why she would help one queen to actually do what a previous queen, Anne Boleyn, had been executed for allegedly doing just 5 years previously. So it may be that she was put under pressure by Queen Catherine. It may be that she stumbled across something suspicious and then was unwillingly drawn into this whole thing. But she does help arrange liaisons. She gave evidence and said that, in her opinion, she thought probably Catherine had been having an affair with Thomas Culpeper, and she lost her life alongside the Queen for that.
Charlotte, let's talk about some of the fictional representations, and maybe even starting with Six the Musical, that has been a huge international sensation ever since it first premiered in 2017. And I know in your exhibition catalogue, you have a part of the exhibition is the costume for Catherine of Aragon from Six the Musical, a performance in 2020. And it's interesting the way I think that maybe that musical maybe led to a revived interest in their stories, but also about telling their stories in a different way.
Yes, that's very fair to say that prior to Six the Musical, that asking sort of general awareness of who each of the queens were, that there would have been kind of lots of recognition of Anne Boleyn. Maybe people would have known about Catherine of Aragon. And then understandably, it gets a bit confusing of, are there eight wives, six wives? Are there too many Catherines? Now, following the kind of incredible success of this musical and the way in which it's structured, that there is an army of fans that know exactly who Catherine Howard is, exactly who Anne of Cleves is, and have this kind of biographical structure in the songs that each of the queens perform. So I think their sort of individuality, even though the musical title is just Six, their individuality has really kind of been shared with a different audience through the musical. And that was one of the things I kind of wanted to think about in the exhibition by including costumes of the different kind of modes of storytelling about the queens and the space there is to approach their stories in different ways. So we have the Catherine of Aragon costume and these incredible designs by Gabriella Slade, and who has spoken about the way in which she uses Tudor portraits as kind of reference points in the kind of square neckline, influences of stained glass and the kind of profile of suits of armor and kind of rivets, and then as filtered through the lens of kind of Beyoncé. But what's kind of, I find really interesting about the costume is that it doesn't sort of explicitly reference a portrait as, say, the costumes worn by Anne of Cleves in The Mirror and the Light, the third part of Hilary Mantel's Thomas Cromwell story, which we have on display from, borrowed from the Royal Shakespeare Company, which is a very kind of close reproduction of Anne's clothing as seen in Hans Holbein's portrait of her. But by contrast, the Catherine of Aragon in Six is much more kind of free association. But you don't need her portrait because in the structure of Six, each of the queens have a microphone. They address the audience themselves. They can speak for themselves. And so they don't need a portrait to speak for them. And that's something that's, I think, kind of resonates with the way that portraiture is used across time. It's about making the absent present. And if you're meeting the person, you don't necessarily need their portrait.
And in your programme, you talk about how Hilary Mantel talked about tracking down the historical record when she was looking into this and wanted the costume to match the portrait of Anne of Cleves. So there it was about getting the historical accuracy right and capturing this young woman describing herself as almost an English woman. So they were very keen to make that. That was important in terms of the story they were telling.
Yes, because sort of Hilary Mantel's sort of way of writing, as she spoke about in frequently and often in the Reith lectures that she gave in 2017, this kind of very research-driven process and that kind of idea of taking sort of the history facts that we can find and then pushing it further through the historical imagination and then her skill as a writer in structuring that into a story. And that's been a really interesting kind of thread throughout, I think, in the kind of fascination of the Tudors, of this space for different writers and creative responses to kind of fashion stories out of what is known in the facts. And Hilary Mantel put it beautifully in her lecture, talking about the last days of Anne Boleyn, of saying that some stories bear retelling, they compel retelling. And there is something in that idea that we kind of keep returning to this period, something draws us back again and again.
And I think you also have a drawing of the costume designs for Charlotte Rampling, who played Anne Boleyn in the movie Henry VIII and His Six Wives.
Yes, really excited to be able to include these costume designs by John and Anne Bloomfield for the BBC television production. And this was a series that aired at the beginning of 1970 of a series of six 90-minute films dedicated to each queen. And the costume designs were made kind of on a shoestring budget, and these incredible costumes with kind of spray-painted paper clips, the sort of artifice of the smoke and mirrors, which then worked on screen. And these costumes were a sort of phenomenon and actually went on display. They were exhibited at the Victoria and Albert Museum and in other places. And huge crowds went to go and see them. But because of the sort of way in which they were created and very sort of pragmatic decisions, that lots of them don't survive. But we have their designs in the exhibition, which are brilliantly made of John and Anne Bloomfield's sort of technique of collaging sort of Sunday supplement magazines. And so you look at them and you just really want to kind of engage with the creative process of making these kinds of costumes.
Nikki, do you have a particular favourite in terms of the fictional portrayals of the six women? Or as an historian, do you find that you're always finding things that are not quite historically accurate and that drive you mad? Or are there some that really do capture your imagination and you say, well, that's getting the story correct?
If I watch a fictional portrayal or read a fictional portrayal, I try and take my historian hat off just a little bit. Because, yes, not everything is always 100% accurate, but so much is open to interpretation that it might simply be that I see that wife in a different way and neither one of us is necessarily right or wrong. I do enjoy Hilary Mantel's portrayals of Anne Boleyn and Jane Seymour in her Thomas Cromwell trilogy.
I do also enjoy Six the Musical. I think that that really brings them to life in a modern sense.
And Nicola, what about you? Is there one that stands out for you?
I think it has to be Dorothy Tootin as Anne Boleyn. I think she really captured Anne's feistiness beautifully, and also to some extent her sex appeal as well. And I think that what was interesting is that she also did a great job of capturing the intensity of her relationship with Henry. So for me, that's a real standout.
Well, tonight we are talking about the lives of the six women who were married to Henry VIII. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll explore their legacy, find out why we are still fascinated by their story and how we should view them. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history and we're talking about the six lives of the women who were married to Henry VIII, inspired by a brilliant new exhibition in the National Portrait Gallery in London. There's also a book accompanying it, Six Lives, the Stories of Henry VIII's Queen. I'm joined by the creator of that exhibition, Dr. Charlotte Bolland, the senior creator for 16th century collections at the National Portrait Gallery in London. Also rejoined by Dr. Nikki Clark of the University of Chichester, who's an expert on the Tudors and the author of The Waiting Game, as well as Gender, Family and Politics, The Howard Women. And Dr. Nicola Tallis, the prolific author, historian and historical consultant, whose books include the wonderful All the Queen's Jewels, Power, Majesty and Display. Well, Nikki, let's maybe talk about how we should remember or think of these women, because I think for too long they were maybe only talked about in terms of that relationship with Henry. But how should we view them? We want to view them not as victims, as people with agency or a certain amount of agency, but how do you think they should be remembered?
I think, to be honest, nuance is the key. So I think in many ways most of them were victims, but not only of Henry VIII, but of the patriarchal systems of the day, and that's the case for most women. But it's not all that they were. I think it's very easy to see them in a one-dimensional way. But actually, they might be victims, but they also did have a lot of agency within their specific context. And I think we can remember the positive things that they did as well. And we can look at the way people thought of them and remembered them at the time in order to add to that.
Nicola, do you think there's a danger that perhaps as we move away from seeing them as victims or just victims, and as we view Henry VIII in a different way, in a more negative way, and look at his faults and his failings, that is there a danger that we risk idealising the women then and seeing them as heroines and 21st century icons rather than applying that nuance that Nikki was talking about there?
Yeah, I think that there is always a balance to be struck with these things, and we have to be careful. Of course, we want to remember these women as extraordinary women in their own right. But the reason that we are talking about these women in the first place is, of course, because they were married to Henry VIII. And it is that relationship that really brings them and their stories to the fore and gives us the opportunity to come to know them as individuals. So, as with all these things, I think it is very much a question of trying to be objective and strike a balance.
Nikki, if you could go back in time in a time machine and meet one of these women and perhaps have them for dinner, which one would you choose?
For me, it would be Catherine of Aragon. She was there for such a long period of time that she must have seen so much of the development of many systems of government, of Henry VIII himself. She was at the Field of Plot of Gold, which was a giant peace summit with France in 1520, where the tents were literally made of cloth of gold. And she also had such an interesting background and upbringing in Spain that I think I'd want to ask her about all those things.
Wonderful. Nicola, what about you?
Very easy question. And for me, the answer is definitely Catherine Parr. I think that she's a woman who has, until fairly recently, been very much overlooked and, you know, dubbed as kind of the nursemaid, the survivor queen, but actually she was extraordinary in her own right as being an author. I'd love to ask her about her writing and her approach to writing, and also brought some much needed glamour to the court with her extensive jewel collection and her magnificent wardrobe. So easily Catherine.
And Nicola, do you think that the later queens suffer because of their place in the order? You know, I'm sure if you were to ask people to name some of the wives, we would find it a lot easier to get the early ones, Catherine of Aragon, Anne Boleyn, and then maybe Jane Seymour and Anne of Cleves. But there's definitely advantage in terms of how we remember them, the ones who are the earlier wives.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think that part of that is because of the length of time for which these latter queens were married to Henry, which was, of course, much shorter. But I think what's interesting, definitely from my perspective, studying them from a dual perspective, is that in many ways we actually know more about the latter queens than we do about the earlier queens, thanks to surviving jewel inventories. So I'm very grateful for that and for that opportunity to come to know these queens better and bring their stories more to the fore.
Charlotte, when you were putting the exhibition together, did your views of the women change as you discovered more materials and as you looked into their lives in more details? Did you start off with one impression and then end it with a different impression?
Yes, I think the thing that sort of took me by surprise slightly was how much I've kind of enjoyed the process of learning more about all of them, of kind of thinking that I was very familiar with their stories and then actually kind of learning more and more. And one of the sort of approaches that I took was looking through, there's an incredible inventory taken of Henry VIII's possessions after he died, and it lists kind of every single thing, sort of castles and guns, cloths of silver and gold, jewels, paintings, table napkins, everything, across all his palaces. And to think about the traces of the queens kind of within that inventory and what the possessions that you own kind of might tell about character. And one of the people that was most sort of useful for in a sort of tiny crumb is Jane Seymour, because her reign is so brief that there is very little sort of trace of her. We don't have caches of her letters. We don't kind of know what books she owned, what books she read, kind of her patronage. She's very hard to kind of approach as an individual, even though we can recognize her because her portrait was copied repeatedly as her family wanted to proclaim their kind of relationship to her and therefore to the future king, Edward. And in looking through the inventory, I found sort of two things that just kind of struck me about Jane. One, looking at images of Mary Magdalene, who was an incredibly popular figure in the sort of models of women and female behaviour at court, that lots of images of Mary Magdalene are found everywhere. And I do wonder if Jane Seymour actually kind of adopted Mary Magdalene slightly, because there was no name saint. Catherine of Aragon and Catherine Parr were very interested in St. Catherine of Alexandria. Anne Boleyn kind of portrayed herself as St. Anne during her coronation. And I do wonder if Jane Seymour, the kind of model of Mary Magdalene and this idea of kind of faith and devotion and obedience within that kind of helped shape her identity. And then in a slightly sort of different perspective, resonance, it seems that Henry VIII kept a number of Jane's possessions in Whitehall in a kind of separate space, that her memory was kind of preserved. And amongst these possessions are two little embroidery slips, just pieces of embroidery, of a lily pot and a falcon and stump. And the lily pot is associated with the Annunciation, and the falcon and stump was Anne Boleyn's emblem. And that idea of perhaps when Jane Seymour was serving Anne Boleyn, is this something that she was making as a gift for her queen, for her lying in as she prepared to give birth and to have the kind of the heir that Henry was so looking for, that then didn't happen as Anne sort of miscarried. And then that idea of quietly setting aside these bits of sort of her service to then take Anne's place. And I think it's really interesting trying to kind of approach the psychology of that moment of Jane, her rise, overlapping so much with Anne's downfall, and what kind of a person might do that.
Well, the exhibition, as I say, runs until the 8th of September in the National Portrait Gallery. Six Lives, the Stories of Henry VIII's Queens. Dr. Charlotte Bolland is the creator of the exhibition and also the editor of the book accompanying it. My thanks also to Dr. Nikki Clark of the University of Chichester and Dr. Nicola Tallis, the prolific author, historian and historical consultant. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, for putting tonight's show together. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so I hope you can join us then. We've been talking history. Good night.